I returned the planning homeworks. The MDP homework should be returned shortly, so will the mini projects. And the other thing is that soon, I think before about November, in the first week of November, you would be asked to, by first week of November, you should put up like a progress report on your projects. Okay. And if there wasn't any progress, then you're going to make some between now and then, I guess. So I guess that's, I will, in the same place on the wiki, you will just add to your project what has happened, you know, how much you have done, what is remaining, etc. I understand that miracles can happen in the last week, and then the project will be significantly better than, you know, what you wrote in the progress report. It's mostly about the final project, but, you know, this is just to sort of put some discipline to see, you know, where you guys are. Okay. And then another thing is that, let's see, where are we? So I am not completely sure. So we basically, I'm going to have another homework set on the belief space planning and farm DPs. That will be coming out soon. I am at this point, I mean, there is a final exam date for us. That's actually on 12:15 from 9:50 to 11:40. I haven't actually made up my mind as to whether we should also have an in-class midterm separate from that or not. If there is an in-class midterm, it has to happen very quickly, I guess, presumably in like next week time frame. So any of you who would like to get an in-class midterm, please send me an email. Okay. And this is not a joke, because if you think that there would be very little to judge you on without a midterm, then you should care about it. Okay. If I don't get any input, then I'll just make my own decision and let you know. Okay. So that's where it's going to be. And, you know, I still reserve the final exam. There is a final exam time separately. The homeworks actually are going to be there for, I think, two more homeworks probably will be there. You know, one for the belief space and one for whatever else we'll do after this. Any questions? Okay. So today I am going to go through the farm DPs and value iteration for farm DPs. Have all of you read those few pages? Okay. So presumably we can go reasonably fast, and you can stop me in parts that you didn't understand. And otherwise, you know, this is obviously a more technically involved thing, at the end of which we basically say we don't plan to do it anyway, because you know, value iteration is just way too complex, essentially. But it's worth understanding, you know, how things work, you know, in the case. Okay. Anyway, so just repeating some things that we said last class. So this is your general model of the farm DP, and you know the usual reward model. And then the planning horizon can be finite, infinite, or indefinite. Okay. And in fact, we'll see that mostly what we will do today is, the one that was described in the textbook, the one that you guys read, is that value iteration for infinite horizon or finite horizon? It's finite horizon, okay? And it's basically P space hard for finite horizon, and, you know, infinite horizon is even more. In fact, basically, in the case of infinite horizon, you don't have any guarantee that your value function would be piecewise linear, which is a big deal for this, right? You had the value function being piecewise linear. Infinite horizon palm DPs. I have a slide in this. By the way, in terms of the slides itself, I took the entire tutorial, but then I took a couple of slides from that, and then I threw in a variety of slides today just to be more directly connected to what you read in the textbook. So that's what you will see. And then at the end of some level, there's like a big slide saying slides beyond this are not covered. And you are welcome to read that rest to see approximately what else is done in PalmDPs. There's a large, you know, there is a reasonable number of people who work on PalmDPs, and it's a great normative model. And if you start talking about distributed agents, then it's the PalmDP that you need to generalize, not the MDP. And we talked about this in the very beginning of the class, because if I have other agents, then I don't know what's in their head. Even if the rest of the world is completely observable, what's in the heads of the other agents is not observable. Okay, so essentially you have this idea of DEC PalmDPs, which is decentralized PalmDPs. Okay, and you know, these are all, I think there are two ways of understanding MDPs and PalmDPs and DEC PalmDPs and all these things. One as a normative model, and the other as a computational model. So the normative basically is, it tells you what is the optimal thing to do. Okay, if you have full observability, what is the and generalized reward functions, what exactly is the optimal thing to do? Okay, and then you may or may not have to, and this aspect of it is very important, because you need to know, I mean, I say in undergraduate classes, and I guess get to say it here too, that the difference between a programmer and a computer science person is a computer science person, first of all, understands what is the optimal decision making and gives up on it because it's too hard. And the programmer doesn't know, doesn't care, you know, just basically does some program which does something, okay? So it would be interesting if you actually, so the MDPs and PalmDPs should certainly be understood in terms of their normative properties as to, you know, what they tell you about what an optimal policy is. And but then these ideas like direct policy value iteration techniques and computation of optimal policy as the only way for an agent to actually behave, that's an overkill, because sometimes it's a computationally intractable problem in most cases. Okay, so we actually noticed that for the MDPs, the policy construction is actually polynomial in the number of states, but even that we didn't directly do it. You know, things like FFHOP and all these things essentially do it by just, you know, maybe online decision making or approximate policy construction and so on. Okay, but then when you say approximate policy construction, it's kind of nice to know, what are you approximating? What was the thing that you're trying to approximate? You know, as again, it's just I'm doing something and I would like to call it approximate. I think that's the normative model aspect. And, you know, understanding PalmDPs and MDPs and DEC PalmDPs from a normative model is very important. You can also spend a lot of time coming up with good, you know, slightly better algorithms than the existing ones for the value and policy iteration for all these cases. And, you know, these are the places where essentially it's extremely easy to say that your idea is exponentially better than the other guy's idea. Okay? If the entire problem is polynomial time complexity, then your sorting algorithm can never be exponentially better than your friend's sorting algorithm, unless your friend has been repeatedly dropped on their head, right? Because they also wrote a polynomial time algorithm, you also wrote a polynomial time algorithm. How can yours be exponentially better? Okay, but here we are talking about, first of all, minimum exponential, more like p-space hard and you know, undecidable. So it's quite easy to actually generate more efficient algorithms. But it's also depressing, so you can, when you look down, you feel very happy because there are real losers below you. But when you look up, you feel very depressed because they were able to, let's say, solve a PalmDP with, you know, 100 states in 2 days, and you are able to solve a PalmDP with 100 states in only 12 hours. Okay, and then as the number of states increases, things just go, you know, exponentially or worse, you know, double exponentially harder. Okay, so that's the way, I mean, so there are a large number of interesting ideas in PalmDPs. In terms of improving the basic value iteration algorithm, the tutorial actually gives some of the ideas of that. Okay, but I'm not going to go into that. Okay, so this is fine, this is fine, there are applications, and I mean, the fact that PalmDBs have applications is not surprising, because the model is a very general model. Everything actually is a PalmDB, really, unless you want to also model the agent's heads, in which case it becomes deck PalmDB. It's more than that. And then I talked about this last time, the finite horizon case, it's piece-based hard, and this should make you take a, you know, make you stop in your track, because it's piece-based hard in the number of states. It's piece-based hard in the number of states. So it's exponential of that in the number of variables, state variables, okay? So it's like truly, horrendously hard problem. Because normal deterministic planning is p-space hard in the space of variables, in the propositional representation. This is for computing the optimal policy for finite horizon. And I was mentioning last time that if in fact you do not have any observations, that means you have no ability to observe whatsoever, then basically it's also a PalmDP. In fact, there is this idea, I mean, you know, I think if you look at the Boutillier, Hanks, Dean papers, they talk about PalmDBs. When you say MDP, normally people mean PalmDB, fully observable MDP, and then PalmDB, which is partially observable, and NOMDP, which is non-observable MDP. And if you have a non-observable MDP, then in essence, you do not have a, you do not need to talk about a policy, right? Because a policy essentially says, given where you are, what is the action to do? In a NOMDP, you have no clue where you are, and you will never have any clue where you are. So you basically come up with a line plan. You just start, do this, do this, do this, do this, and say, I'm done. Okay? So it's going to be, I mean, NOMDP is basically, for the deterministic case, NOMDP is for non-deterministic case, NOMDPS is what we called as conformant planning problem. And for probabilistic case, NOMDPS become probabilistic conformant planning. Those are the solutions. Okay. Anyway, so this basically is saying that NOMDP is cheaper, essentially. Okay. And again, I was mentioning last time as to why you can make sense of this, because this one is only going to be a line plan. And if you fix the horizon, then essentially, if you fix the horizon, that means you fix the length of the plan. That's the only number of actions you get to do. Whereas within that horizon, you can do sensing, and then basically do a large conditional plan, which is which has exponential number of branches, which has exponential number of line plans, essentially. So that's the way to understand that. Now, in the case of infinite horizon, it's undecidable. And, you know, approximations are more tractable. But these are all, these NP hardness results, don't be too happy. They are NP hard in the number of states, not in the number of literals. Okay? Not in the number of state variables. Okay? Okay, so, you know, a PalmDP is specified by states, actions, transition function for the actions, reward function, okay, and this much is just like an MDP. Yes?
What happens in the infinite horizon case if the model is unobservable, is non-observable?
What does it mean? What do you mean in this sense?
Like, you had given the case.
Yeah.
If unobservable.
Oh, so I mean the complexity for the infinite horizon conformant planning, I think that's an interesting question that corresponds to the picture I showed in the previous set of slides, because remember I showed this kind of a picture, p-space complete for the deterministic planning, and if you do partial observability or if you do non-deterministic actions, then it becomes x time here and x space here. And then if you then add PO for this or ND for this, it'll become 2x. Okay, this picture is not horizon dependent. Because when generally when we ask for planning complexity, we have to understand that p-space complexity of planning is clearly not horizon dependent, right? Because if it's horizon dependent, that means it's going to be linear in the length. It's, you know, it's going to be a particular length, and that's part of the input parameter now. And then you will be able to actually, they'll only be, it'll be in the class NP in that case. And the p-space happens because of the Tower of Hanoi, for example, where you get to have an exponential length plan. And if you have an exponent, and that, this picture is for non-deterministic scenarios, and infinite horizon, essentially. So that would give you some idea as to what the complexity is. Okay, what you want specifically here is infinite horizon probabilistic conformant planning, not infinite horizon non-deterministic conformant planning. Okay, but the non-deterministic conformant planning is hard already because you're making every one of the goals states to reach the goal. Okay, so I would think I'm not 100% sure, but this is your. If you have both non-deterministic and partially observable, then double X is your, it's something like double X. I'm not completely sure. I have to check. Okay, but that's the best answer I have right now. So going back to MDPs, so you have an MDP, on top of it you have a finite set of observations. Okay, so the observations basically, apart from a transition model, remember what is a transition model? The transition model for an action itself, P S dash given S A. I mean, if you do action A in state S, what's the probability that you will get to state S dash? That's the transition model. Okay, and the observation model is basically probability of evidence E given state S and action A. In, the more simpler case is probability of evidence E given state S. So what's the probability that, this basically is saying if you are in state S, what's the probability that you will get evidence E? Okay, observation E. And if it is 1 and 0, then that means those are deterministic observations. Otherwise, they are probabilistic observations. That was the difference between the previous conditional planning stuff we have done and this, where it is actually noisy observations. Okay, so you have a transition model and an observation model. And then, so the thing that we were talking about last time okay, the thing that I was talking about, okay, so that's your observation model, and then we talked about this as to why the PMDPs are hard. There are two ways they become hard. One, of course, is number of states itself. And then, so the value function, as the number of states increase, then essentially the size of the belief space is increasing exponentially. Okay, and then there is this other issue, which is the value function now. Actually, let me get to that a little later. The point we were making last time was if you have a PMDP, then essentially your decision depends on the history of observations you got up until that point. And the history of observations can be summarized either as a belief state, which is a sort of a distribution over the real states you are in, and or a sort of a, it can also be summarized in the plan itself. The plan keeps track of partitions the history into finite set of equivalence classes, and then it keeps track of which equivalence class it is in using an internal variable. So the plan has a state which is different from the state of the world. Okay, So those are two ways of doing it. This is what is used if you actually do policy iteration for PalmDBs. Okay, but we would mostly not talk about this at all. It's useful to know that when you have partial observability, the plans will now become, you know, the control, the plans are no longer just open controllers, but they actually take, they have internal state. And they take an observation, they use the internal state to decide what action to do. Okay? And then as far as this one, the belief space is the one that you discussed, that the textbook was talking about, also for the value iteration. There you just have each belief space, belief state is essentially the probability that, and a probability distribution over the states, the real states. Okay? And so the number of belief states obviously is infinite because it corresponds to a simplex in the space of states. I think there's like a picture somewhere here, yeah. So if you have just two states, belief states are all points on this line. Okay, and if you have three states, belief states are points on that plane, that triangular plane, okay. And any point on that corresponds to a belief state, which basically, and then these points correspond to having full knowledge about which state you are in. Okay, and remember that if you are trying to talk about policy, then you are saying if you know which belief state you are in, you want to know what action to do. So the original problem was, I have got the following set of observations, what action should I do? That has been converted into, I am in the following belief state, what action should I do? And the belief states are basically points on this thing, okay? So the policy takes each point here and maps it to an action. And then in the normal MDP case, we had an intermediary between the policy and the states. Right, one that is the value function, which is a real valued maximum reward you can get starting from this belief state and doing action. Okay, so that would be, it's like, you know, on this simplex you are now defining a function. Okay, for each point on this simplex there is a value for that function. Okay. And one thing that you will sort of realize is it's kind of interesting that whatever that value function is, you are going to realize that there is no, given the model, and it's also intuitively true, that uncertainty cannot increase your value. Okay, so that means the value function has to be higher at the edges and lower in the middle. Higher at the corners and lower in the middle. Because the corners, essentially, you know which state you are in. Okay? You are in the middle, you have the highest amount of uncertainty. Right? And as you increase state uncertainty, you know, there is no reason why. So basically, that's essentially saying that if I tell you that you are in either state 1 or state 2 or state 3 with one-third probabilities, and I ask you to do the optimal thing possible, and then I will look at the optimal reward, the reward you got in the maximum case, maximal reward you can ever expect to get, okay? That cannot be more than the reward you could have got either by just starting here or by starting here by starting here. Okay, that's the point, yes, sir. No. All I'm saying is, I'm not saying that your value here has to be. All I'm saying is that the S1. So okay, here's the deal. If you say one third probability, right? This, the value of this, cannot be greater than all of V100, V010, V0, 0, 0. It can't be greater than all three of these. It can be greater than one or two of them. Do you see what I'm saying? Because that's the point of having, you know, you would basically, if you then, in, you know, that what you're saying is that one of these states could be really, really bad state, and reduce it, and one of these states is really, really good state, and having some positive probability of being in a good state will increase the ability to get to a better, you know, better reward. But then, in that case, then I can also tell you that if this is the state that you really, really like, then this one, you should have done much better than this. And that essentially means that the value function would be convex. Okay? Actually, I think it should be called concave. it's lower in the middle and higher in the edges. Okay? What else do we want to do? Now, the other point, you know, I thought I was making this in the background, that while the Markov decision, the PAMDP is not Markov in the space of observations, because you can't just make your decision based just on the current observation. You can make your decision based on the current state, but you don't have the current state. Okay? So all you have is the observation, and you can't make your decision just based on the current observation. You have to make it on the history. So in the space of observations, it's not Markov. But in the space of belief states, it is Markov, because belief state, in essence, captures the history of observation. Okay? And that's what this is saying. And I mentioned this multiple times, and now here is just a technical definition of the actual MDP transition. Okay? Now the point is, remember I wrote this as the transition model for the actions, this as the transition model for the, this is the observation model, this is the transition model, okay? But these are not going to define an MDP directly by themselves. A combination of them defines the underlying MDP, because what you need to know is what's the current belief state, and if I were to do this action, what would be the next belief state? Okay? So this is your transition function. This is your transition function over belief states. Just as you had probability S dash given you did action A in state S, now I need a transition function of if I am in belief state B and I did an action A, what is the probability that I will be in belief state B dash? Now remember, belief state B dash itself is a distribution. Right? So what's the probability that you would be in this distribution if I did this action in this distribution? That's what you're going to compute. And that would be the transition model for our MDP in the space of belief states. Okay? Just before getting there, so the other issue is, what is the reward model for the belief state space? And that is easy. What we'll assume is if I have a reward for the reward model for the belief state B is just the expected reward over all those states. Do you see what I'm saying? So if I'm in state S1 with probability half and state S2 with probability half, and I have reward, you know, 10 for the first state and 20 for the second state, then the expected reward is 15. So the belief state's reward is expected reward of this distribution. That's all. That's what I would use. Okay? So this is the reward function. And then and going back here, this one, to talk about probability that you will be in this distribution given you do action A in this distribution, you essentially write this by conditionalizing over the evidence. If you remember, the picture was, let's see. The picture, essentially, the execution picture for PAMDPs is like this, right? You are in a current belief state, and for that belief state, the policy tells you what action to do. You do that action. When you do that action, you get an observation. When you do that action in the real world, you get an observation. Okay? Using the observation and this action, you then compute the new belief state. You compute the new belief state. Okay. If this were to be MDP, what would have happened? This is the PalmDP picture. Okay. And in fact, in the PalmDP picture, we'll see in a minute that computing this new belief state is a non-trivial problem. That's what is called state estimation problem. And most filtering algorithms essentially estimate their state based on the observations they have got up until then. Okay. Is there a state estimation problem for the MDP case? Because you know the state. You open your eyes, you know the state. There is nothing to estimate. Okay. Whereas here you only know, when they say state estimation, really what they mean is computing your new belief state based on the action you did and the evidence you got. You'll never know what your real state is. You just know more about the current distribution. Okay. So actually, since I talked about that, let me skip over this for a second. I'll be back in a minute there and go here. Okay. So this is the same picture that I was showing, except in stuff in the tutorial they were using Z to mean evidence. In the textbook they meant E to use evidence. So I just changed this to E here. Okay, that's the same picture that we just saw. And the question, of course, is how do I compute my belief state after doing an action A and observing evidence E? Okay, that is what the controller does during execution. Okay, the controller for MDP, in contrast, is a much simpler controller. It just says state, look into the policy, do the action A, you'll get state. There is nothing to estimate the state. Okay, the action A with the world will tell you what the state is. Before you did it, remember one of the interesting things, even in this picture, this is the controller for MDP, in the sense when it is actually executing, as soon as it does the action, it knows the exact next state after it does the action. But when it is thinking about doing the action, which is what planning is all about, you don't get to do the action, you just think about doing the action. You're simulating in the head. When you simulate in the head, you essentially have to consider that this, when you do an action A in a state S, you can get into multiple possible states with multiple different probabilities. That was the transition model that you use. Do you get what I'm saying? So you need to use the transition model in the context of making the plan. When you're executing, you don't need to use the transition model because the world actually tells you what the reality is. Okay, and in this case, basically, you again have to, and so you keep that in mind and then you look at the more complex scenario right now. So when you did the action A, you got an observation E. So to make this picture MDP, then the observation E should tell you what the state is. Or at least it should be the case that the observation E uniquely identifies the state you are in. Okay. So what is interesting normally is based on, suppose in the beginning you are in a state one third, in a three-state PalmDP, you could be in any one of the states with one third probability. Okay. And then you did an action. Based on that action, you could have simulated the, in your mentally simulated using the action's own transition model. So if this action is appearing in this state, let's see. So you are in one third state, and you did an action. So this is S1 one third, S2 one third, S3 one third. In a three state PalmDP. You did an action A. And action A has its own probability S dash given SA model. That means if you were to do this action in S1, let's say, it will take you to S2 with some probability, and S3 with some probability, and S4 with S1 back with some other probability. Okay. So what you're really doing is when you do this action, you have to think of, you could have been in this state, in which case there is a distribution. You could have been in this state, you could have had another distribution. You could have been in this state, you could have had a third distribution. You add them up. that would be the distribution of doing this action. Okay. Now, so after doing this action, you get essentially, we think you would essentially get some random, let's say, 1/16, 1/4, and then 1 minus this stuff. Right? Okay. Right? That, let's say, that's my thing. So now, let's say, if the observation says, no, let's say you got an observation E star. Suppose according to the observation model that you have, okay, probability that you get E star given S is 1 for S1 and 0 for S2 and S3. Okay? Then what do you think is your, during the execution, then what do you think is your belief state now? Right after the action, so you do action and you get observation sort of instantaneously. But you can conceptually think of it as you do the action and then next instant you get the observation. So right after the action, you think you are in this belief state. But your observation tells you you got E star, which means you must only be in S1. So you rechange this belief distribution such that it actually becomes 1, 0, 0. Those are the two steps that happen in state estimation. This is the idea called filtering in general. And basically, you look at the action, you assume based on the belief state, you get the new belief state, and then you condition it using the evidence that you actually got and recompute the belief state again. And the one that you get is the one that you're going to use. And that aspect is that's what is called the filtering or state estimation problem. Okay. So in particular here, the new B dash, the new belief state B dash, is defined as the probability of S dash in the new belief state B dash is defined in terms of, first of all, the probability of being in state S and doing the action A in S to get to S dash. Okay? You sum over all SS. There are multiple ways to get to S dash after doing the action A. You could be doing state in S and do this action, S3 and do this action, S5 and do this action, and all of them will get you to S dash with different probabilities. You sum all those probabilities. Okay? When you did just this part, then you are sort of here. Then you do the Bayes rule and you multiply that by the probability of evidence given S dash. Now, because this is actually Bayes rule, you should really write this divided by some denominator. That denominator winds up being the same for all the states, S dash. So instead of writing the denominator, I'll write alpha and I'll pick the alpha to make sure that all those things sum to 1. That's just the normalizing constant. The interesting part is this is during execution. So MDP execution is trivial. There's nothing that goes on in MDP execution. You are in the state, you pick the action, you get a new state, you pick the next action, you get a new state, pick the next action. PAMDP execution itself is interesting. In fact, most of the robotics like Kalman filtering and all these things are just about the state estimation problem. If you see the actions being done and if you see the observations and you want to figure out what is the current state based on the actions and observations, that's the state estimation problem. Okay? And now you got the B dash, the policy is going to be indexed with respect to B dash. Okay? And then you're going to just pick the action from that policy and then do that. And then go around. Okay. Now, this is during execution. At the execution, you know what the actual belief state is. But if I want to talk about the underlying MDP, I should give you this, which is the distribution over all belief states, given that you did this action in this belief state. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's exactly the same thing you do in MDPs too. Even though during the execution, you essentially don't have to take the transition model into account, you know, action transition model into account, in the planning, you have to take it into account. Because in the planning, you have to consider what's the distribution of the states you'll get into if I were to do this action in this state. Okay, now this is this, what's the distribution of, what's the probability of getting into different belief states that I do this act, given that I do this action in this belief. Okay, now, and so that is basically condition over different possible evidences you can get. You don't know which evidence you will actually get. Suppose there are a finite number of observations you can get after doing the action. You don't know which one is actually going to happen. Okay, so you have to condition, you have to marginalize the evidence and say this probability is nothing but probability that you will get to B dash given that you did action A in belief state B and got evidence E. This thing, by the way, this thing is that. That is, when you get this specific evidence, how do you compute the exact new belief state? Okay, and that is this times probability that you will get evidence E when you do action A in belief state B. And you do this and you sum this over all the evidences. Okay, and that is your transition function. That is your transition function. Okay, and then, you know, if you have that as a transition function, this as the reward function, then you can actually write a Bellman equation for the value function, which almost looks like the Bellman equation for the full, you know, form DP. So it basically just says value of a belief state B is max over all the actions you can do, reward that you can get, plus the discount factor times if you do, you know, take the values of B dashes and the probabilities that you'll get into B dash doing when you do B. Okay, the only misleading thing here is this is not a summation. It should be an integration. Right, because it's actually over continuous belief states. So it has to be an integration. Okay, and in fact, there is a humongous temptation to do summations because that's like discretizing an integration, right? And we will talk, hopefully, towards the end of the class, a version of approximating value iteration, which is called point-based value iteration, where, in essence, you say, all I care about are 18 different belief states. So even though my simplex is like this, I will say this, those are the only belief states I care about. Okay, and then I basically am computing the value for, and then every other belief state somehow has to become close to one of these belief states. So you're representing a continuous function in terms of its discrete values. And that will not give you optimal optimal value for the continuous case, but it makes life easy, significantly easy, it turns out. And so point-based value iteration is something that people do to actually make value iteration more tractable for palm DP. Okay. Yeah, so this is basically what, this slide is the same thing that I mentioned in these two slides. This is from the textbook, okay? Okay, so now we finally get to talk about value iteration for palm DP. Okay, and the basic idea that they mention, and I'm sure you got it by now, if you read it, is essentially because you have continuous space of states, then basically he starts asking the question, so the belief states are continuous, but the number of states is still finite. Okay, by the way, before I even got here, actually, you could have fully observable continuous MDPs. Fully observable continuous MDPs. We just didn't talk about it. In fact, one elephant in this room, in most of I-71, is we don't like continuous quantities. We haven't talked about them much. Okay, this one we were dragged into continuous quantities even though we started from finite state spaces. Okay, so if you are thinking of writing the value function in some compact form, then you can actually say that the belief space, a belief state, is a distribution over states. Let's say the value associated with each plan, which what they called alpha, is also written in terms of, so suppose I am in some state S and I do a particular conditional plan. We'll talk about in a minute, but a conditional plan would look like this. Okay, and then so these are all the actions and these are the observations. That's your conditional plan. So you start from your initial state and then based on the observations you get, you do the next action, which is the top of the, so basically if you are in this state, you did action A and you got evidence E1, then you do the next action in this branch. If you got evidence E2, then you do this next action in this branch. Okay, if you are thinking in terms of these conditional plans, which are the only choices an agent really has? What conditional plan is it actually going to do given the horizon left? If it has only one horizon, then it can basically its conditional plan would be a single action. If it has horizon two, then it gets to do an action, get an observation, and based on the observation, do different action. If it has horizon three, then this goes 3D and so on. Okay, so the value iteration basically is thinking in terms of, given a plan like this, okay, I want to be able to talk about the value this plan gets in as alpha p, but alpha p is a vector of values that it will get in each of the states S1 to Sn, the pure states S1 to Sn. And then the advantage of that is then if I have given a belief state, where the belief state is essentially the probabilities of being in these states, then you take a dot product of this vector with this vector, then you get the expected value for the belief state. Okay, that's what they are doing. So they get these alphas, which are essentially the pure value you can get by doing this action starting from one of the states, one of the known states. And then the belief state will tell you the actual distribution over the states, and the expected value for a belief state is the dot product between the belief state vector and the alpha vector. Okay. And then, so the other interesting point is that the value function for a single plan, now, remember that if I have a value function for a single plan as a vector, let's say, and then the belief space is another vector, and then so this is the alpha function, and this is the belief space. This is the belief state, and the true value V is alpha times alpha dot B. Okay, and so in essence, the value is linearly proportional to the values in the pure states. Okay, which means they define hyperplanes in this over this simplex. Each value for an alpha will define a hyperplane over the simplex. Okay, and the picture here, which you will get sick and tired of after a while when you see enough MDPs, is to give a graphical interpretation, they look at the simplest possible case of two-state MDPs. So in a case of two-state PAMDPs, although belief state, basically even for a two-state PAMDP is a continuous case, I can essentially, this is just a one-dimensional scenario, right? If I just know the probability for one of the states, then the other is one minus that. There's only one dependent variable, one independent variable for a two-state case, for the number of probabilities. So what you're doing is, this one is essentially just saying, if this tells you the probability of being in state S1, okay? So here, let's say probability of being in state S1 is, actually they keep using different things. the picture that the textbook uses. Let me get back to you in a minute. Let me get to this in a minute. Okay. The picture that the textbook uses is the probability of state 1 is 0 here and 1 here. That means probability of state 2 here is 1 and probability of state 2 here is 0. Okay. So going back here, so then essentially the value, if you have an alpha, remember for this particular two-state scenario, the alpha vector for any given plan would be a two-dimensional vector. Okay, and you multiply that, you take the dot product of the two-dimensional vector with the belief state vector, and you'll get a number. Okay, and that number would be actually just the value corresponding to S1 in the alpha here, and the value corresponding to S2 in the alpha here. And then in between, it'll just linearly raise or fall. Okay, so that's why it's sort of in this particular case. That's why it's a, you know, it's a, actually a line. But in n-dimensional case, you will have a hyperplane for the value of individual subplans. Okay, now the interesting question, of course, is, and so if I can do a one, as if I only have one action I can do. I can do A1, and let's assume if I do A1, I get this as my value function. And if I do A2, I get this as my value function. I'm not just an observer. I have free choice. Since I have computed these, when I am here, would I ever pick A1 as my action? No, because I want to maximize my value. So when I am in this belief space, I have two possible values I can get. If I can get this value if I do A1, I can get this value if I do A2. So I'll do A2. When I am in this part, I will do A1. So the true value that I actually can get, given that these are the only two actions I can do, suppose I am in a world where only two actions are there, then it's really the upper envelope of those. Do you see what I'm saying? It's an upper envelope of those two. Okay? And so that's basically, for two cases, it's this. And so if you just have, this will be your value function for horizon one. And in a finite horizon value iteration, you take the value function for horizon k, and you can compute the value function for horizon k plus 1 in terms of the value function for horizon k. That's what you do too here. And that's the more interesting part. Okay. So anyway, so in the dynamic form DP, so in the dynamic programming in this case is in for horizon 1, you would have realized this is the value function. And this value function is now going to be used in computing the horizon 2 value functions for individual plans. Now, when there is a horizon 2, suppose in this world I have two actions, A1 and A2, and only two observations, O1 and O2. This is the simplest possible world. Then the number of different plans I can do is, you know, each plan would be a conditional plan. This is the O1 side, this is the O2 side. I can put either A1 or A2 here, A1 or A2 here, A1 or A2 here. So 2 cube, 8 different plans. So these are all the 8 plans that I can do if I have horizon 2. And for each of them, using the same idea, plus using the dynamic programming part, which is taking the value from the one horizon, I can compute the hyperplanes for each of these plans. This is one hyperplane, this is one hyperplane, and so on. Once again, I'm not an observer. I'm not just a passive observer. I get to make decisions. Since I know this is how the valuations of all these plans are, I will wind up taking the upper envelope. Okay? And furthermore, so basically now the belief space between, you know, between belief state space, which is actually a continuous quantity, has been split into regions such that in this region, you would have done this action. In this region, you would have done this action. In this region, you would have done this action, and so on. Okay. The tricky problem, of course, is essentially this is sort of the kind of thing that also happens in LP, you know, polytopes. The interesting question is, what are the effective constraints and what are the dominated constraints? Okay, in this particular case, suppose you have this action, there is some particular plan which gives you this. So one of these 8 plans, there are 8 different lines here. Okay, one of these 8 plans is giving this line. It would have been so good not to have generated it, right? Because it's dominated in the end. You see what I'm saying? So there's a lot of work that gets wasted, computing these dominated plans and removing them. And the reason, and now remember that in the normal MDP, you always take a max over all the actions you can do. Remember, the dynamic programming equation always has a max. Max over all the actions you can do, the best reward you can get. Okay, and that's why when you're taking this upper envelope, that's like a max operation over a bunch of lines. Right? That's the right thing to do. Okay? So that's basically the value iteration algorithm. And the tricky part, of course, is two different issues. One is how much of a fragmentation can happen here. This little region can be split into infinite number of, potentially infinite number of small regions. Okay, such that for every small region, there is a separate action. Okay, but for all we know, we can show basically the theoretical guarantee we have is for finite horizon palm DPs, right? Finite horizon palm DPs, this will always have finite number of segments. Yes?
How we can predict that this is the kind of dominated action and do not compute it?
It's not obvious. No, actually there are multiple, I mean the PBVI is a case we'll talk about. If I just decide only certain belief states are relevant, then I will only keep those actions. So for example, if I happen to know, let's say, that this is an important point, then I could avoid generating or keeping any plan which is not even correct at that point, I mean, which is not the maximum at that point. Normally you can't just do that. You have to look at all the points and see, is there a small region where, so this line looks like a loser line, right, most of the time, but then it's not loser in this little region. Whereas if I give you a finite set of points, you can actually just evaluate that, you know, the alpha times b for just that particular belief state and see if it is already dominated. If so, you just don't consider that. That's what PBVI does.
But in general case, we have to compute all the actions.
Yeah. Yeah. And the numbers are staggering. Mm-hmm. Numbers are staggering and astronomical. Okay. So in fact, I think, so anyway, but it's kind of nice. What's interesting is conceptually, this is doable. Right? Whether you want to actually do it before you die is a different story. Whether it'll ever terminate before you die is a different issue. Okay? Conceptually, you can actually compute the optimal value function. And if I do compute, so for any finite horizon value function would sort of, you know, look like this. And I will store the value function as these segments and their regions. Okay, and if I'm in that region, I will pick that segment, and that segment tells me what was the plan that it corresponded to, and I do the first action of that plan. That's the policy. Right? Okay. Because when we did this previously, we said, oh, there's a belief state, you just index into the policy, and the policy tells you what the action is. This is non-trivial because the number of belief states is infinity. Okay, and so you need to kind of look at which segment in there, which segment is your belief state falling. If it is falling here, then this is the maximum value, and this value came from one of these plans, and you keep track of that, and do the first action of that plan. That's what you're supposed to do. Okay. And that's basically is what is written in the textbook in this particular case. So the utilities, you keep track of the alpha of a plan in terms of what you will get for pure states starting with this plan. And then if you have a belief state, then the value for the belief state is B times alpha. So it will be a hyperplane in the space of belief states. Okay, and you will be taking the max over the plans because you are an agent with free choice, free will. Okay, so if you think, once you think, then you realize this is dominated in this region by this other guy, I will pick this dominating one. Okay, and then the other interesting thing, of course, is the utility function will always be sort of concave, and that's because the higher the uncertainty. When you have higher uncertainty, you can't, I mean, the highest uncertainty in terms of the entropy of the distribution. Think of the entropy of the distribution. Okay? If you have high entropy, which basically is 1 over n for n state space, that's the maximum amount of uncertainty. And that cannot be better than every possible pure state. It can be better than one of the, some of the pure states, the really loser one. Do you see what I'm saying? But here's the other thing with respect to Randy's question in the beginning. We are not just falling into a bad state. We are planning not to fall into a bad state. Okay? So you would basically, if your feel is to, let's take the action A1 most of the time, but if you do action A1 and if you happen to be in state S2, you will get minus infinity. Then when there is any probability of being in state S2, you would not touch action A1. Okay? And so basically over the max, so that this is the maximum value that is attainable for a given horizon, and that value function will be convex, will be concave. Okay? And that's what this is saying. Okay, and I'm just going over the example once more in the book. That one without the numbers, this one with numbers. So the book actually looked at the very specific case of two states, 0 and 1, and the reward for 0 is 0, reward for 1 is 1. Okay, and you have only two actions, stay and go. Stay will keep you in the state you currently are in with 0.9 probability and take you to the next state with 0.1 probability. And go will keep you in the current state with 0.1 probability and take you to the other state with 0.9 probability. So stay and go are like stay and go that you assume. If in a two-state world, stay means stay where you are, go means go to the other state. Okay? Except they are noisy. That's why 0.9 they do what they say they will do, and 0.1 they'll do the other way around. And then sensor reports the state number, but it's only correct with 0.6 probability. Okay, so if it says you are in state 1, then with probability 0.6 you are in state 1, and with probability 0.4 in state 2. If it says you are in state 2, then you are probability 0.6 you are in state 2, and probability 0.4 you are in state 1. Okay, so this is like as simple a PomDP as you can get, and it's like very nice to actually just follow that reasoning just for that example. And he assumes discount factor is 1, and these are your alpha functions. So remember that since there are only two actions, and you have just, let's say, horizon is 1, horizon 0 is, so if your horizon is 1, then essentially you can only do one action. So you can either do stay or go. If you do stay, I want to know what's the best I can get if I'm in 0, what's the best I can get in 1, and then similarly go 0 and go 1. Okay, and those numbers is basically telling you that this can be computed correctly. Okay, all you are saying is staying in 0 is reward of 0 plus 0.9 of reward of 0 and 0.1 of reward of 1. Because after you do stay, you will actually stay in 0 with 0.9 probability and go to state 2 with 0.1 probability. Okay, and this is the total reward you'd have got, accumulated reward you'd have got in that one horizon. And this one will give you 1.9, this is 0.9, this is 1.1. Okay, so the alpha vector for stay, is 0.1, 1.9. This is the alpha vector for stay. And the alpha vector for go is 0.9, and 1.1. So then I can compute the value function for stay plan for a given belief state by multiplying that belief state with this dot product of the belief state with that. Okay, since I am in a kind of a one dimensional situation, then these are the two lines that correspond to the value functions I get for stay and go. Okay, and you can sort of see that that makes sense if you are, this is the probability that you are actually in state one. This is the probability that you are actually in state one. And if you are, so remember that, so all this one is saying is stay would be 0.1 if you are actually, if probability of being in state one is zero, that means you are fully in state one, in state zero. And that will be 0.1, this side will be 0.9, and similarly, this for this guy, it will be 0.9 on this side and 1.1 on that side. Okay, and then so you take, that is your value function. So in this region, of course, you'll do go, in this region, you'll do stay. This much you can see, actually, right? If you actually think, remember that the happy state is 1, if you think you have less than 0.5 probability of being in happy state, then going is better. Otherwise, somewhere near 0.5, and otherwise staying is better. Okay, so that's what you did. Okay, that's for the first one. The second one essentially will be, you know, if I have two iterations. So if this would be your value function for horizon one. Now, if you want to compute a value function for horizon two, then you have to use the value function for horizon one and this equation to compute the value function, the alpha values first. And then you multiply alpha with beta, with the belief state probabilities. Okay? And you should convince yourself, and I'll make you do, I guess, in a homework, that, for example, here again, you will have 8 different plans, right? Because there are only 2 actions, stay and go, and 2 percepts, state 1 or state 2. Okay, and so there are exactly 8 plans, and this is one of that, this is another of those. And, you know, every conditional plan can be written as a nested if-then statement, right? Okay, start from somewhere, and if this is true, then you do this, otherwise you do this, and so on. Okay, he wrote it in terms of if-then statements, and so he will get, he basically says he got these as the actual value functions. I mean, the actual value functions for individual plans. But you get to choose which plan for what region. Okay, and you do that by essentially taking the upper boundary. That one will tell you for what region is what action optimal. Okay? So that's basically the two horizon value function. And then value, once you got the value function, you know the action to do, because the optimal value there will tell you which plan you used, and the first action of that plan is what you'll wind up doing. Okay? And so notice what this is being, what is this action, this one is useful to understand. This is the recursion in which basically gives you the alpha vector for a particular plan P in terms of the alpha vector for the branch of that plan. Because notice that if this is a plan, then this dot E1 is this plan. This dot E2 is this plan. So what this equation is talking about is it's basically giving you alpha vector for a bigger plan, this big plan, in terms of the alpha vector for this plan and this plan. Okay? And that's your recursion. And that's basically, and this you would have computed in the previous horizon. And now you are computing this in the next horizon. Okay? So that's what will get you like a nice little recursive formulation, and you know, you have a value iteration where you compute horizon 0, horizon 1, horizon 2 values, and up to whatever horizon k you want to compute it, and then that's how you get the value function. Okay, and then the point that I was making last time, and this is probably the last thing we get to say today, is basically, the maximum amount of work that gets done is just generating. The number of plans just goes exponentially as the depth increases. Because the number of branches is equal to the number of observations, and the number of valuations for each node is equal to the number of actions, and you want to compute the number of distinct trees of that depth. It's going to be exponential both in the actions and the it's e power the number of actions, I believe. And so what happens essentially is, for the finite horizon case, you will compute huge number of these plans, the valuations for huge number of these kinds of plans. Okay, and many, many of them are actually dominated, and that's all wasted work. And is there a way you can avoid doing that wasted work? And there are, 10,000 ideas that are floating about, And as I said in the beginning of the class, the computational complexity of value iteration algorithm is so horrendous that you can get very easy exponential improvements while still not being anywhere near practical. Do you see what I'm saying? So the existing algorithm, for the longest time, actually when I first started tracking PAMDP literature, I think like in around 2000 or something, 1998 time frame, for example, people will write, give an entire tutorial on PAMDPs and say things like, we can solve as high as 8 state problems in under days. That's what the exact approaches do for you. Okay, and when you start basically it's that slow that it's easy to improve it. Any reasonable idea you will get will improve it, but it will still be probably not anywhere close to being practical. Okay, so the PBVI, that's actually if you want optimum or guarantees of quality, the other idea that we'll talk about next class and which you have already read is just do something like RTDP, which is basically just to fix depth, look ahead, and then pick the action. Okay? Or you can do something like FFHOP kind of idea, except for PAMDPs. Those are all quick online decision makers, which will pick an action and then hope for the world to tell it what to do next, and then pick the next action, rather than doing the complete value function upfront. This is, value iteration is offline method, right? It computes the full policy upfront, whereas an online decision maker looks at the input it got, the observation it got, the action it did, the observation it got, and then decides what's the best action to do if I'm just doing one action, and then wait for a while. So the online decision maker never has to think in terms of fully conditional plans. Basically, the entire conditionality is shown in the tree. It's like, the game tree search or the RTDP. In fact, one of the things it would be worth doing is compare this stuff, which was in the textbook, to real-time dynamic programming, which we mentioned for fully observable MDPs. They're very well connected. One of the interesting things you will notice is actions no longer introduce uncertainty. Why? Because an action will take you from one belief state to another belief state. Okay, the uncertainty is in terms of the evidence, the observations that you get. But anyway, so that is what mostly gets done if you're using PAMDPs. But if you are trying to compute, if you're trying to improve the policy construction, offline policy construction for PAMDPs, here is one simple idea which, I'm just throwing a picture here. I'm not giving you the full details. But this is called the point-based value iteration, where, as I said, they just keep track of some specific belief points, and they say those points are special, and we want to know what to do there. And the rest we'll just interpolate. Now, obviously, they can't be sure that way they will get the exact optimal value function. But, when it works, it can reduce the number of the work tremendously. So, for example, this picture is showing that the full value iteration algorithm would have computed these many hyperplanes, right? And would have basically picked those top ones. Whereas this one would have computed much fewer hyperplanes, and very few of them are, essentially none of them in this case are dominated at all. That would be, in these kinds of scenarios, the best you can imagine is compute only those ones which will be optimal somewhere. It's easier said than done, but that's what you're trying to do. And if you can do that, you can cut down some of the complexity of computing this upper boundary. Okay? So I am, this is all finite horizon. Okay? And then if you want to do finite horizon policy iteration, then you essentially, I mean, I won't talk about it, there is slides about this in the rest of the slides, but you essentially think in terms of finite state controllers and see which finite state control is the best. So just like you start with a policy and tweak it to see if it becomes, it improves the value, you now the policy is represented as a finite state controller, and you start with that, and then you tweak the finite state controller and see which of them has a better value function. And then the one which is higher, you pick that. I mean, you know, and then you keep doing it. Okay, and that's a better way. So they say, for example, one slide next to this says it can be 10 to 100 times faster than the point-based value iteration. I mean, so normal value iteration. 10 to 100 times is nothing if it's if it's E-space hard. You see what I'm saying? So this is what I'm saying. If you want to write happy curves where you are way better than your competitor, then PomDP is a good place to be in. And in fact, DECPOMDP is even better, because the baseline is so horrendously bad that anything you can do, if you can somehow, put your head around it, bend your head around it, you can actually come up with interesting improvements. Okay, but then the improvements become few and far between when the baseline becomes better. You know, that's why nobody comes up with better sorting algorithms. You know, they're always coming up with better PomDP algorithms, because the complexity is pretty bad. And then for the infinite horizon case, things are really, really, really bad. Okay, because first of all, for the value iteration, essentially, again, you can do epsilon convergence. Okay, but then there is no actual guarantee. There is no actual guarantee that the value function is piecewise linear in the end for the infinite case. That means there is not even a small region where there is a line, which essentially means the worst case that can happen is, as much as you might think, what a pain that I have to remember each of these pieces and the action corresponding to that piece, imagine the alternative, which is for each of the points you should know what to do, and you die. Okay. By the way, point-based value approximation is essentially taking a continuous space and looking at particular exemplar points. There are also grid-based approximations. So you take a grid, so you can convert the PomDP into a discrete, I mean the belief state space into a discrete space by taking a grid and say there are only those many points. That's the other one. Okay. There are also many algorithms on that too. Anyway, so infinite horizon, it's bad. But it turns out that in some cases, apparently, it's actually piecewise linear. Okay. But in general, I don't know anybody who's actually doing infinite horizon PomDP. Okay. We'll stop here. We'll talk a little bit more maybe about PomDP next week, but I'll start another new topic next week. Yes?
In LP mathematical programming, it is not very tough to get rid of extra constraints.
Actually, they do, some of the ideas they do is essentially using LP for this.
Yeah, so yeah. I just wondering why this is that much tough here. Because
you are doing an LP for each iteration. For each iteration, you're doing a multiple LPs, right? So you can, so the number,
LPs is, I mean, increasing a lot, but the point is, I mean, we start with just kind of, I'll say, finite number of extreme points.
Yeah.
Then, and each iteration, we just increase them by some, like, room.
Yeah, no, I think, you're right that if it is, in fact, a small number of states, LP formulations would do reasonably well. Okay, it's just that first of all the number of states is high, and so there are in fact some of the approaches that work for PomDPs are based on LP formulations. But work is a relative term. Okay, PomDPs are most popular in the OR community with like 8 or 9 real states. When you have thousands of states, then you are kind of dead, basically. So it's not that you can't do, this looks ugly on the picture, but it's not that this is hard to do, for a modern computer. But this is only 2 states.
Yeah.
And if you have multiple states and you're doing this at each iteration, it can add. Okay. This is also a question of how long can, what's your patience in terms of how long are you going to wait for the optimal policy to be computed. I mean, this is a computer, it's an algorithm, and it has a finite complexity, so you can actually, you know, you can solve it.
Polynomial,
okay,
yeah,
it's not polynomial. No, it's basically, I mean, if you think in terms of what is the input, if the input is number of states, it's p-space hard in the number of states. That's what we said. It's not polynomial. Per iteration.
Sorry, if you have n number of states, and we want to do n number of LP, then it's polynomial solvable, because LP is polynomial solvable.
Yeah.
And if you do it n times polynomial solvable, it should be polynomial solvable, isn't it? Well, I don't know if I'm missing something. If you're doing n LP, it's polynomial solvable.
Yeah, no, it's not, first of all, clear to me that it's n LPs. These are the number of plans. Each line here corresponds to a separate plan. The number of plans depend on the number of actions, number of observations, and the depth.
Okay,
and they are exponential in the actions, observations, and depth. Because remember, the two-sized plans with two actions, the two-depth plans, there were two cube of them. Yeah, I mean, so basically it's exponential in the number of actions
two,
too.
2^n.
Yes.
In fact,
so
I think the exact number, but the way that n is not the number of states, by the way, that's the number of actions. Because the number of plans you are considering is what matters, and that's not in terms of states, it's in terms of the plans are expressed in terms of the actions and the observations. But that's also an input parameter. For an MDP, the input parameters are the number of states, number of actions, number of observations. Okay, so your complexity is decided in terms of these input parameters. And we know at least that the number of plans would be exponential in the number of actions and observations. And the number of LPs would now be exponential, of course, in the number, for each iteration, they would be exponential in the number of actions and observations.
Okay.
That's it.
Thank you.